Very gratified that after planning for 3 years, we are finally launching Inside the Activist Study. The idea behind this series was born from the popular and long-running series on Bravo, Inside the Actor's Studio. For 14 years, this show has provided in-depth, thoughtful interviews with actors, directors, and producers. Broadcast in more than 89 million homes, this show has garnered much critical acclaim, including more than a dozen Emmy nominations. Clearly, this is a format that works. Our idea was to use the same format and to expand upon it. We wanted to bring to Tufts journalists, filmmakers, actors, and activists who've used their professional platforms to talk about important issues of social justice and social advocacy. We want to be exploring what it means to be an activist in today's world. What do you need to know? What do you need to do? How can you use the media so the media don't use you? This series will be an opportunity to hear the reflections of well-known activists from many fields talking about their art and their craft. While Actors Study is taped before a live studio audience at Pace University, we wanted our series to be more interactive, and so we'll be using the second part of tonight's program to pose some questions that we've solicited from audience members. We're absolutely thrilled to premiere our series tonight with two extremely distinguished journalists who have devoted their careers to documenting important social issues and taking a stand on them. At a time when few journalists are willing to step over the imaginary line of objectivity, David and Amy Goodman's work stands out as bold, honest, and innovative. Their roles as journalists, as activists, and as people who are incredibly committed to the causes they believe in are very much in sync with our commitment at Tufts to civic engagement in all of its forms. Tonight's program is co-sponsored by the Communications and Media Studies Program, the Peace and Justice Studies Program, and the Jonathan M. Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service. I'd like to thank all the students and staff who have worked so hard to make this event happen tonight, especially our CMS staff assistant, John Champa, students Sarah Ullman, Sarah DeForest, and Kristen McConnell, and special thanks to my colleague Dale Bryan, who has been a tireless advocate for this series from the very beginning. I have been asked to point out to you that there are exits in the rear, that the bathrooms are in the back and to my left, and also please be sure to turn off your cell phones and pagers at this time. We also have two different cameras filming the event tonight, so please, if you need to get up, don't walk in front of the cameras. At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dean Vicki Sullivan from Arts and Sciences.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to welcome everyone to tonight's event. This event, as you've heard, is the inaugural event for a new series at Tufts entitled Inside the Activist Study. This series is the product of a very useful collaboration between two different interdisciplinary programs in the School of Arts and Sciences, Peace and Justice Studies, and Communication and Media Studies, in conjunction with Tisch College. Arts and Sciences endeavors to support this type of collaborative and interdisciplinary endeavor as it brings together interested parties with different academic backgrounds, information, and interests to consider the methods of efficacious leadership for social change. Personally, I'm intrigued by the juxtaposition of action and contemplation in the title of this series, which is obviously intentional, but also revealing. As we know, as Julie Dobrow told us, it's a play on the famous television series Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton. But generally, we don't associate activists with the study, with solitude, but rather with a community, with the public square, with the media, with the street, and now with websites and social networking media. But that's precisely what's intriguing about that series, that endeavors to have activists reflect on their activity, its purposes and its methods, so that as students, scholars, and activists ourselves, we can learn from their reflections regarding writing, outreach, and leadership. On behalf of the Tufts community, students, faculty, and staff, I would like to say that this collaborative enterprise of this series and this event are to be welcomed. Thank you, Julie Dobrow of Communication and Media Studies and Dale Bryan of Peace and Justice Studies for your efforts on behalf of this series and this event. Now I turn the podium over to Dale Bryan of the Peace and Justice Studies to introduce tonight's guests. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki. Good evening, everyone. I, too, want to welcome you and to thank you for joining us tonight. It is my pleasure to introduce two rather extraordinary people who, for all their noteworthy activities and accomplishments, are intentionally allied to ordinary people the world over who struggle for social justice. Through their investigative journalism and writing, they help reveal the important strategies and tactics deployed by movements and everyday people who seek a better world. By their storytelling and their own example, they help reveal how heeding your deepest convictions and values, and by acting together, that a just, sustainable, and peaceful future is possible. It's not certain, but it is possible. Amy Goodman is an award-winning investigative journalist and syndicated columnist, author, and the host of Democracy Now!, which airs on more than 800 public television and radio stations worldwide. Amy is the first journalist to receive the Right Livelihood Award, widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, for, quote, developing an innovative model of truly independent grassroots political journalism that brings to millions of people the alternative voices that are excluded by the mainstream media, close quote. The Independent of London named Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! An inspiration. PulseMedia.org placed Amy at the top of their top 20 global media figures. She is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. Her latest book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, proves the power of independent journalism in the struggles for a better world. She co-authored the first 3 bestsellers, Standing Up to the Madness, Static, and The Exception to the Rulers, with her brother David. David is also an award-winning investigative journalist whose articles have appeared in The Washington Post, Mother Jones, Outside, The Nation, Los Angeles Times, Christian Science Monitor, and numerous other publications. David has been a frequent guest on national radio and television shows, including PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Pacifica Radio, NPR's Fresh Air Morning Edition, Talk of the Nation, CNN, and, surprise, Democracy Now! In addition to this writing with Amy, he authored most recently the acclaimed book Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. His reporting is included in the American Empire Project book In the Name of Democracy and in No Easy Victories, African Liberation and American Activists Over a Half Century, 1950 to 2000. Please join me in welcoming them to Tufts and to the Activist Study.
So to really have this look like our study, we took this very literally. We brought some of our favorite books along to decorate the room with.
Now, since we're in a room full of students and some teachers and professors, I figured we'd start with your early years, David, as a young student around the age of 7 or 8. But it wasn't about school. It was about being at home. Now, I'm 2.5 years older than David. He's my baby brother. But it was David who really inspired me, along with my older brother, Steve, to go into journalism, because David started a family newspaper in his room, in our house. When you entered our house in Bayshore, New York, there were signs pointing upstairs all along the wall that said Dave's Press. David was 8. And the printing press was on his bed. It was one of these old Xerox machines that he burned the image of each paper into the next. And it was sort of a glorified family calendar where he reported on what we were doing every month. When he reported on a particular date in a particular year that my mother had spanked me, she put her foot down. She cried, "No family dirty laundry goes into this newspaper." David cried censorship, and he really cried because he was 8 years old. And it was the beginning of a great free speech advocate. And maybe, David, you could tell about the letters to the editor page, which were phenomenal. This went out to the greater Good People family, to my grandparents, to our great aunts and uncles. They were all immigrants from Eastern Europe. And they would battle in the editorial pages and letters to the editor with David over the Vietnam War. What did Grandpa write to you?
Well, many of my relatives, we had some deep fissures within the family. Uncle Sock was an underwear salesman on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, quite reactionary, and was constantly warring with Uncle Joe, who was a socialist. And basically, like spontaneous combustion, at any moment in a family gathering, it could erupt into a full conflagration between these two men. So I guess those are some of the formative images I have of how where politics happens. It happens all over the kitchen table and basically at every family gathering, and it generally is very messy affair. And requiring elderly aunts to pull these men apart. So I would, Dave's Press reported on the goings-on in my comparatively sedate family with Amy, but it did branch out. I mean, this was the late 60s when I was 8 years old, so there were a lot of burning issues of the day, and this was where we began talking about them as a family. Well, we would talk about them at these family gatherings, but I saw sort of chronicling them as it just sort of seemed natural. It was an extension of what was going on over our table. There were some heated debates over things like my grandfather complaining that I charged more than Newsweek for a subscription, to which I replied, I told the truth and Newsweek didn't. So I thought that was worth something. But anyway, coming down here, as I was driving down from Vermont, where I live, and I was thinking, as with most interviews, I needed to jot some notes. But every time I went to jot something down, I sort of, my hand pulled back thinking, do I really need to jot notes to talk to my sister? And as we were walking over here to Barnum Hall, Amy commented, I thought, very sagely, well, we've only been preparing for this talk for our entire lives. So I thought I would begin by asking, many of you may know Amy through Democracy Now! And her writings and speakings, but you might be surprised to learn that it was a rather unconventional preparation or route that led to this kind of reporting. Amy and I both went to the school down the street, Harvard, but Amy left to go to Maine. And she went to College of the Atlantic, took time out, went to College of the Atlantic, and then became part of a bakery collective in Bar Harbor, the Sunflower Bakery, where she was part of a very vibrant community and, among other things, delivering wonderful whole wheat bread throughout Maine. So I thought I would ask you, Amy, what is the connection between whole wheat bread and independent media?
Now, you didn't tell me you were going to ask this question, but, well, after being there for a few years, we baked thousands of loaves of bread every week, and granola and cookies, and delivered them in a little pickup truck through the state of Maine every week to the little, well, you don't call them bodegas in Maine, but the small shops, co-ops, supermarkets. And I thought the coup would be to be able to get whole grain organic bread into the school system in Maine. Because how important nutrition is for young minds and kids growing. But we could not compete with Wonder Bread. They could stay on the shelves for 2 years, as was pointed out to us. We, you know, after about a week, the bread would get moldy because it was alive and because it was healthy and it was nutritious.
It was less than a week that it would get moldy.
But we did get our bread into Arby's, the chain in Maine. Rich Dan's Baraffle Brothers, or roast beef, because they were interested in organic buns, believe it or not. And I used to debate with the owner of Arby's when he first called our little bake shop in Bar Harbor and said, hello, my name is Ken Raffle, and I'm interested in buying thousands of buns, of whole grain bread for our chain of stores. I said, excuse me, could you tell me what time it is? And he said, well, it's 5 to 12. It was 5 to noon. And I said, would you mind calling back in 1 hour in 5 minutes? Because at noon, from noon to one, I go to the post office and I stand with a little sign that says peace on earth for an hour. And it just prompts very interesting discussions for people on their lunch break. Call me back in 60 minutes. And he said, I'm making an offer that we will buy thousands. He says, you've never probably gotten there. I said, just then call me back in 1 hour for sure. And we had very interesting political discussions every week when I delivered the buns to Arby's. But that sent me ultimately back to school. And I was taking some courses in nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. And my first class in nutrition, the professor was talking about the myth that sugar is harmful for you. And I was very surprised at that. And I raised my hand and I said, well, if nothing else, what about the cavities? And when I walked out of the class, there in the School of Public Health was a little plaque that thanked Domino's for that wing. And it was not the beginning of this journey, because I certainly had known about the power of corporations in determining what we eat, what we take in, what we learn, how we view the world. But I ended up doing my undergraduate thesis on a drug called Depo-Provera, which is an injectable contraceptive. A woman takes every 3 months. It wasn't approved by the FDA at the time. And I couldn't afford to go abroad to see how to talk to women who'd been injected with it. It wasn't approved in the United States, but it was sent out to more than 70 countries around the world. So I went in this country to Atlanta, Georgia, to the Grady Charity Hospital, where 10,000 African-American women had been injected with it, not knowing that it was not approved by the FDA. It makes women sick in many cases. And it started, it was the beginning of the Black Women's Health Project, because so many women were getting sick. And a health activist named Billy Avery started this group. So we turn, I did this thesis, and I have to make this fast because I have to ask you about South Africa. It was very interesting to do this thesis because I interviewed many people and I majored in anthropology. And I went to defend my thesis and there were three male professors who were there. Interestingly, my thesis advisor, I went outside my school to find someone who could relate to this story. And Laura Nader was visiting Wellesley at the time, the anthropologist from UC Berkeley, sister of Ralph Nader. And I ended up hooking up with her, but she wasn't at this thesis defense. And it was three male professors, and I sat down and they said, you know, I was looking forward to leaving school, I have to admit. And I knew I had to graduate in the next few weeks. And they said, well, thank you very much, but we wouldn't really consider this a thesis in anthropology. maybe you would consider this for sociology. So I said, sociology? I mean, I knew I wouldn't be graduating then because I hadn't taken classes in sociology. And they said, that's right. And the doctor said to me as he took a drag on his pipe, what is your definition of anthropology? And I thought, well, if I'm going to graduate, we better have the same definition. So I said, well, what is your definition of anthropology? And he responded, well, anthropology is being a participant observer in someone else's culture. That gives you the distance, although you're visiting inside of it, to be able to have some interesting observations. But you're looking at your own culture, he said, and that's the problem here. So I said, actually, I agree with you. I do think that is the definition of anthropology. And that's why I think this is the perfect thesis for anthropology, because I'm looking at a white, male, corporate culture of science in this country, and I don't consider myself a part of that. I'm looking at you. And he said, carry on. So I graduated, and then I thought, well, I didn't really just do this for three people who would certainly never be injected with Depo-Provera. I want to ensure that, you know, when you spend your time looking into an issue, that the word gets out, that, you know, what you do can really make a difference in the world no matter what age you are. When you put your efforts into something, make sure it has the best effect. And so I worked with a colleague at school, Katrina von Henneberg, Christine von Henneberg, and we published this magazine called Multinational Monitor. We did the whole issue called The Case Against Depo-Provera. And that really was the beginning of my period after school going into journalism. During school, we revived a feminist newspaper on campus called Seventh Sister. David, what about you in South Africa? Because you started right here, too.